Angie Abdou was born in and spent her early years at Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. She studied at the University of Regina and the University of Western Ontario and earned a PhD in creative writing at the University of Calgary in 2009. Angie currently lives in Fernie, British Columbia, divides her time actually between there and Alberta. She's a professor of creative writing at Athabasca University. Her 2006 work, Anything Boys Can Do, was published by Thistledown Press and was followed in 2007 by her first novel, The Bone Cage, published by New West Press. In 2011, The Bone Cage was a CBC Canada Reads finalist. Her other works include The Canterbury Trail, Between, and the book we'll be discussing today, her fifth work of fiction, In Case I Go, published by Arsenal Pulp Press in September of last year. Frank Bush is a member of the Nisitchawayasik Cree First Nation, where three rivers meet. He studied at the University of Manitoba and has written articles for the Vancouver Sun, the Winnipeg Free Press, and the National Post. His 2014 novel, Grey Eyes, was published by Roseway Publishing. That novel came out after he had done hundreds of interviews with Indian residential school survivors. Frank Bush lives on Okanagan Territory at West Bank First Nation in British Columbia. Angie and Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you for having us, Wayne.
Angie, let's talk about the genesis of this book. Like books often do, In Case I Go started out very different story from the one you eventually created. You originally wanted to write a horror novel, and this book is in some respects, I would say, a horror novel, but it's also a lot more than that. It reads to me like a work of social realism, and I'll talk later about genre and my thoughts on this book in relation to genre. But what did that original story look like?
I'm glad that you say that about it being fitting in different genres, because it has been reviewed so far as a horror, a mystery, a romance, a historical fiction, and a thriller, which pleases me very much. Nobody knows exactly what it is, which is perfect because neither do I. But I did start out, I really like the work of Andrew Piper, a Canadian horror novelist, and I grew up liking the work of Stephen King. And there's this weird situation in Fernie where it was mismanagement of graves in the early coal mining days and bad marking. And so there are human remains through several prominent neighborhoods. And I thought, what an interesting setting for a horror story. So I started out wanting to write horror. And it wasn't coming to life. It was very wooden. And then I decided just to write the way I normally do and see what happened and not try to control the process so much. And I ended up writing a book about the ways we're haunted by the mistakes of our ancestors. So the young boy narrator is very much haunted by his great-grandfather's misdeeds, both in terms of environmental exploitation and exploitation of Indigenous peoples.
But just to be clear, in the initial version, there were, for instance, no Tunakka in your story.
No, there weren't. And I had written a novel about the East Kootenai before, the Canterbury Trail, which is a ski bum satire. And there are no explicitly Tunakka characters in that. And I often wondered if that problematic, racist by exclusion, because it's Tunakka character, Tunakka territory. So I thought about what it might look like for me to include Tunakka people in my novels. And, you know, as I struggled with this boy and the ways he was haunted, the Indigenous issue became very forefront, because I think of my own children, all of our children, and how they're going to move forward from this horrible history we have in Canada. And they're going to have to find answers to the state of the planet, for one thing, and the state of settler-Indigenous relations in the country and the right way forward. And it's a lot to put on these little people. And I imagine my little children going forward. And that kind of, I often write from the place of things that worry me, and that my children's future and Frank's children's future worries me. So that's where that came into the novel.
I read this as a study of reconciliation in many senses. So in this story, you have the reconciliation within marriages after infidelities, the reconciliation of families, parents, and children. There's reconciliation across racial divides. You get, of course, reconciliation of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, but there's also religion plays a role in this book, the different religions in this community, and then, of course, the reconciliation of the past with the present. And reconciliation is about as far away from a horror genre as you can imagine, or at least as I can. I mean, horror, there's is about, especially you mentioned Stephen King, it's about unresolved fear, the idea that we are in fact the monsters. We project out into the world our anxieties. But I give you points for looking at reconciliation in this way. I think horror reconciliation may be a new genre. I don't know.
I love the way in your comments you just said, I can see a perfect graduate student essay forming itself. And I love the way you find the different points of reconciliation. And it's so interesting to me that I didn't deliberately set up to write that, but that's what emerged. And, you know, it's the year of where truth and reconciliation is very much a focus on all of our minds and what it means. What does that mean? And how do we put it into concrete action? And what does it mean for me? And what does it mean for Frank? And what does it mean for my children and for Frank's children? How do we enact it? And these are answers I don't have, but I write fiction to explore things that I don't yet understand. So I guess that's how that emerged in the novel.
Well, I'm going to bring Frank in a second. I'll just mention, it makes sense from what I've read about you, Angie, that you would gravitate towards this story because it's a lot of it is autobiographical, really, isn't it? I mean, you have a Syrian grandfather. You've got.
Yes.
I know you and Frank are related. Frank, it's your great grandfather, and Angie, it's your grandfather, the Syrian.
So Frank's grandma is my dad's sister.
Okay. So you don't have any indigenous background. You're related through another branch of the tree, but yet this story does look to me, this novel looks like something that does have correspondence with your personal history.
And I love that you said that it feels like even though it has this fantastical element, it still feels like social realism because my other novels are all very much social realism and this fantasy aspect of this novel is new to me, but it didn't feel any different. It felt like I was writing about social issues. They're important and very close to home.
You mentioned in the acknowledgments Richard Wagamese, and that's where you get this novel's working definition of reconciliation. I'll just read what he told you. You can't undo the past. You don't have to feel guilty about the past. You don't even have to apologize for the past. All you have to do is say yes. Yes, this happened. We can start there.
Yeah, I heard him say that at the Denman Writers Festival, and I was in a very early draft of this, and I wasn't feeling in control of it, and I didn't know what I was writing about. And when he said that, I thought, this is my yes, whatever that's going to look like. This is my start. You know, we take baby steps towards truth and reconciliation. So we start with truth, which is facing the history full on and saying, yes, that happened. Now, what are we going to do about it is the next step. And that's going to have to be broken down into baby steps. But we can start with yes. We can start by learning our own history, acknowledging it. I disagree with Richard. I think we do have to apologize. I feel like I have to apologize. So acknowledging it, saying sorry, and then trying to find out now what do we do to move forward.
Yeah, but first people have to understand what they're apologizing for. So that, I see what Richard was saying there. It's like, first you have to admit that this stuff actually happened, you know. Frank, what was your role in this collaboration with Angie?
I think, Angie contacted me and, said, hey, I'm writing another book. And I was kind of just excited about that. And then she goes, and I'm going to have, indigenous characters or indigenous content. And, I don't really know how I should, go about that. You know, should I, kind of make up a fictional tribe and have those, have those elements there? Or, can I use the actual name of the people who are indigenous to that area? And that's kind of where I said to her that I think that, make up a fictional tribe would be kind of, excluding them or erasing them from history. But that, if you're going to do it, you do need to go through a kind of a process, with that, nation in order to, make them sure that they're aware that you're doing it. And, if possible to, to get their blessing to say, okay, well, we're being represented in a good way here. It's not, stereotypes or, common misconceptions of who we are as a people. And then also being able to respect their wishes because a lot of First Nations groups, don't like to publicize or put in print aspects of their spirituality, mythology, or some of their stories, because the oral tradition is very strong and very relevant to kind of modern legal debate about, what was actually said in the treaties and other land claims issues. So we developed an engagement process, and luckily my day job involves a lot of working with government and industry on how to go about it, and recognizing that the resource development world is very different from the literary world, because I really don't feel like we can censor or limit writers of fiction. It takes something away from the canon of Canadian literature. And I do feel that, if you are writing to a Canadian experience, First Nations people, Métis people, Inuit people are going to have to be a part of that, because I don't see anywhere in the country where, First Nations people are just not involved at some level somewhere. And if you're not seeing them, you're not looking hard enough. It's kind of what mm-hmm. I believe. So we went through a process. We kind of, developed it. And I think it was a bit of a learning experience for both of us, because I'd never really looked at engagement or, the duty to consult from the guise of literature. And we wanted to incorporate all those elements. So we went through kind of a process, of engagement, and seeking, permission or blessing of the Hunaka people in order to include them in this work. So it was very interesting, because I got to read the original manuscript, like the first, here I just wrote this. It's not ready for publication. Don't look at any of this, that, or the other thing, right? Just, what do you think of the content? And it truly, it was a good ghost story. I could tell that. It was like a horror genre ghost story. And then one of the first things I said to Angie was, it's really great, but you can't have a ghost. Like, this character can't be a ghost. She goes, but it's a ghost story. And I was like, yeah, I see that it's a ghost story, but, it's taboo, right? So, the idea of unsettled spirits and that make a lot of First Nations people fairly uncomfortable. So then we ended up with, okay, well, we got a ghost story with no ghost, right? So that's where we decided to have the character be, a mute individual or a person who is troubled, and have it kind of grow from there. So it was a pretty interesting development. And I know there were points along the way where just by these exasperated gasps from Angie, she was thinking, why did I do this? Like, why did I call this cousin of mine? Right? but we got through it somehow, mm-hmm. we just kind of kept going back, and it was, I felt it was a bit of a reconciliation process, because mm-hmm. even within our own family, we have those elements. There's, I guess you might say the indigenous side and the non-indigenous side, and there's denial on both parts in some areas as to who we are and as a family and that. And I thought it was like a really good microcosm for the for Canadian society, and just the ability for Angie and I to kind of work together and collaborate on this a little bit. I really felt that was a bit of a reconciliation and healing process.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there was a point when the first time I got on the phone with Frank after he had read the book, and he was telling me, he started out with it was great, and then he told me the things that were not going to work. And, I was taking notes, and I had about three pages of them, and one was about the ghost. And he said, you cannot have the Indigenous character as a ghost, because you're suggesting that she's airy and insubstantial and of the past. She needs to be like the white boy, she can be possessed. Preoccupied with her ancestors, but she has to be out of this world too. And I thought, what a brilliant observation. And I'm so glad I asked him, because that's not metaphorically what I wanted to suggest at all. But as soon as he said it, I knew he was right. But that was one little line on my three pages of suggested changes. And I thought, oh, wow, I'm in for a lot of work here. So that was the exasperated side, but also much gratitude.
Yeah, I think the question of how well you pulled this off, and I've only just read the book, so I'm still processing things and trying to decide how well that pulls up. But I think the book stands or falls on this question of how well you draw together all these disparate elements, or what I would call the rules of the game, because you could have done it as a straight ghost story, but then you're told, well, no, it can't be. So now you've really taken on an enormous challenge here. I mean, I don't think people who've never tried to write a book and appreciate this, but you've got the whole world of horror stories, you've got the whole world of social realism, you've got a culture and a history that is foreign to you, that you're not part of. So now you're bringing in people, and let's be honest, it's kind of like writing by committee, and we all know how how that can be when you've got other people saying other things, you know, you're being pulled in different directions. So it's not something that I would want to attempt, because this is what I'm saying. I would have probably just said, I think I'm just going to keep this as a straightforward horror story, because this is just an enormous thing.
Well, and I don't like group work. So my initial approach, attitude towards the consultation process was resistance. But in the end, it was the most interesting part for me. I learned a lot, and I do think the book is better. And I talked to one of the elders, Tanaha elders, last night, and he said I have his blessing, and he feels that the book was meant to be written. He doesn't know why yet, but he feels like I was meant to write this book, and he has his reasons. And I feel like I don't know why yet either. I feel like I'm right in the middle of some kind of conflict that I find very uncomfortable with the different responses to my process and to the book. And I feel like it's playing out, and I hope one day we all know why. We all know why I wrote this book. But the process was different from my other books, not only in the collaboration with Frank and with the cultural liaison, but from the Tanaha, but in the way ideas were coming to me. And it's quite mysterious to me, and I look forward to the day when I understand why I wrote this book and what I'm meant to learn from it.
Last week, an article by John Kay comes out. I'm sure neither of you wanted this book to become talked about in this way, for this reason in this way, but here we have it. The article is called Canada Has Gone Mad, Indigenous Representation and the Hounding of Angie Abdou. And I'll read a quotation. Late last year, I wrote an essay, this is John Kay, for Quillette, describing how the fight against cultural appropriation had suddenly gone viral in Canada, particularly regarding stories about Indigenous peoples. The issue has become the subject of full-blown social panic among the country's intellectual class, I argued, and would remain so until artists and authors of color themselves eventually become exasperated by doctrines that limit the influence and reach of their own literature. First of all, Angie, I'll ask you, hounded? Is it?
No, I'm not being hounded. That's not my word. So I'm not being hounded. And the controversy that has erupted is not really even about my book. People are so quick on social media to be polarized and hyperbolic that it seems it's gotten really nasty online, and it seems like it's an argument about cultural appropriation involving my book, but really the conflict is about a 2-page essay I wrote for Cole Inquirer explaining the consultation process. And I wrote that essay because I really enjoyed the consultation process, and I know people are thinking about how do we go forward and how do we write characters different than us, and I wanted to share my experience, and I really wanted to thank the people involved because the cultural liaison I worked with was quite brilliant and so helpful, and I really enjoyed working with her. So I wanted to name names and thank people and talk about the process. And in retrospect, that was a mistake. The criticism was that I should have consulted about the essay about consultation because I got some of my words wrong. I said that the Tanaha Nation Council endorsed my book, but I should have said it was, you know, a nation government does not endorse the work of art. That's blatantly wrong. I should have said I felt and supported by the Tanaha people I worked with. So that's wrong. And I should have, at first I resisted this idea, like, now I have to consult about my essay about consultation. Like, do I have to ask permission for everything? And I was really resistant. But just last night, the woman who I'd worked with as cultural liaison made me see the reason I need to consult is because I don't understand Indigenous government at all. I just realized how much I don't know. I really don't understand. So I don't understand who speaks for whom and what means what. So I misrepresented the process of consultation.
Well, you know,
that doesn't mean that I didn't. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, the other thing being is that the landscape changed as we were working on it and when the book came out. And I think the real key there was the decision by the Supreme Court in Hunaka Nation versus British Columbia. So that was, a Supreme Court case based on the controversy of a developer wanting to put a ski resort on a mountain that is sacred to the Hunaka people. Mm-hmm. The subject of many of their legends, mythologies, and spirituality that did not appear in Angie's book. Part of the issue in the decision was that the Supreme Court deemed that because the developer had spent enough time in their mind talking at the Hunaka people and, you know, going to meetings and doing this, that that process of just kind of showing up and meeting and talking constituted or satisfied the duty to consult. So that's been a major legal change in the duty to consult process, whereby, you know, if you spend enough time talking or at the table, then the duty to consult is satisfied. So that was something that happened, you know, just after the book was released. But prior to that, in the Supreme Court decision, just talking did not satisfy duty to consult. So the consultation process we used was pre-Hunaka Nation versus British Columbia. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't get, is how quickly situations can change, you know, based on, you know, legal decisions that are, you know, well above most of our pay grades in that. So that was a major change. And I think some of the criticism was geared that, like, you know, after this Supreme Court decision, it's almost like, you know, like double think, you know, just as soon as a change happened, everybody acts like it was always that way. And that was really not the case. So the, you know, the process that we went through, the, you know, the consultation and engagement process we used, was, you know, deemed okay prior to that. Now, First Nations people, you know, are going to be very hesitant to even take these meetings because of the Supreme Court's decision in Hunaka Nation versus British Columbia. And, you know, we've both been fairly vocal, you know, in our, you know, opposition to the Supreme Court's thinking and decision on that matter. So, and I think that part was also very much left out, you know, both, you know, you know, the criticisms and some of the social media banter that, you know, both Angie and I have spoken out, you know, against the Supreme Court's decision in Hunaka Nation versus British Columbia.
Yeah, I've been against Jumbo Glacier Resort since I heard the first peep of it so long ago. It's a ridiculous idea.
But, and there's elements of that in your book. And I'm surprised, you know, for some of the criticisms that people are making that, you know, like, oh, well, you know, I got the ski resort here and whatever. And I'm like, have you ever read Angie Abt's work? I mean, there are quite a few elements in there about, you know, big developers and big money coming into, you know, into territories, First Nations, you know, territories and even just small towns, you know, like the Canadian small town is now in danger of, you know, big money coming in and developing and squeezing locals out. And there are elements of that in Case I Go.
And I have read the novel, and honestly, I can't see why anyone would take offense to it. I don't think there's anything in this book that rises to the level of some of the rhetoric. I could easily go onto Twitter and find it. I tend not to weigh in too much on these things because I do sometimes wonder if social media is this alternate reality. You know, people are heatedly discussing a topic on social media and it's everywhere you look. And then you talk to somebody who's not on Twitter or who doesn't use Facebook and you mention these things and they look at you like you've just arrived from a foreign planet. They have no idea what you're talking about. You know, Frank and Angie, you've both made this contrast between resource development and novels, but you do meet the people who say, no, they're exactly the same thing. You know, language is violence, and a white person writing about Indigenous people is doing precisely the same thing that somebody who comes and steals everything from us is doing. So you do actually come across that point of view where it's just the standard is you just don't do this. You don't write about Indigenous people if you're not Indigenous. You don't tell stories if they're not your stories. You just don't go there. I mean, that's the cultural appropriation debate that's happening online, or at least that's one side of it. And then, of course, the other side is anybody can write about anything, and then you just judge the book based on how well that piece of writing works in the end.
And I think we're right in the middle of that conversation, and I would love to be watching it from the outside. Unfortunately, my book seems to fall right in the middle of it. And if it's true, if we decide that people with privilege and power cannot write about other people, because it seems to go the one way that white people can't write about Indigenous people or people of color, if that's the way it goes, then the novel as a form is not going to be the same, right? I can't write a novel if I can only write about privileged white women. That's not interesting. What novelists do is imagine themselves into other points of view and other characters, other lives. And by doing so, they let readers imagine their way into other lives. And it's really an act of empathy. Reading is an act of empathy because it puts you in a different person's world. And writing is an act of extreme empathy. And, you know, I think we have to try to do it as best we can. And we have to try to be respectful and kind. And I think the idea of a cultural sensitivity edit to make sure you haven't been unintentionally exploitive or inaccurate or offensive, all those things are really important. But I hope we don't shut down where people can't write anything except for their own experience, because then writing becomes an act of narcissism.
Well, you can imagine what this novel would have been under those rules. It would have been about Patricia and Stephen and how angry she is that he spends $10,000 on a bathtub. Yes.
The poor white people fighting about money.
Yeah. I should write a novel about that. I'm starting to think here. There's going to be ideas. Like, I could write about a privileged white family and whatever their internal, challenges are in that from a indigenous perspective. I mean, that would be, I wonder how many people I'd offend, mm-hmm. or if I get the same press, like, can't believe this guy is writing about us, it'd be pretty interesting.
I mean, I've talked to people and tried to explore and understand this point of view. And from as best as I can understand it, the argument is there's a history of things being taken, and it's in the context of that history that there's always a persistent danger that when people represent us or speak for us, that once again, as we have experienced so often, things will be taken, or there will be some kind of harm, consequential harm, which derives from the act of representation. I mean, it's not that there isn't a valid point there. I think, though, I don't think you disagree with that, Angie, do you, that mm-hmm. you have to do this in a certain way so that you're not doing what was done in the past, where people would write a novel, and they'd write a novel in such a way that it turned indigenous people into these kind of magical creatures. They were either mystical and magical and nature, connected to nature, or they were savage and barbarian. But either of those polarities kind of made it easier for white people to just not treat them as fully realized human beings with rights and with dignity and with their own aspirations and their own agency. I'm an English major, and Canadian literature was my minor. So I've read books that kind of are pulling that trick and that are, creating a kind of indigenous person or a kind of native person that can be easily discarded when it comes time to build the mine or, move people out of the way to do a resource extraction. So it's not that you're not aware of all of that stuff.
Yeah. And it's also, exactly. And also I like what you said about social media. And I think also mainstream media now, it instantly gets so angry and so polarized, whereas I can have this kind of conversation that we're having right now with anyone on any side of the issue person, and it can be civil, and we can change our minds, and we can meet partway, and we can agree to disagree. But online, it gets so unpleasant. And I know that I'm learning, and that it was a new process for me, and that I did things wrong. And when I spent the last few days with a Chinaha friend, and she's funny. Like, she can tell me where I've done wrong and where I've missed the mark entirely, but in a way that's warm and loving and funny. And her name's Anna Sam Hudson. And she says, she'll start her out of her sentences, "Look, I don't even mind white people, but," and she'll tell me what I've done wrong. And we'll laugh, we're the cultural liaison I worked, and she's like, "I don't mean to be too critical, but you shouldn't have done this." And I finally just said, be critical. I be blunt. I realize I have a lot to learn, and I'm fine with criticism, but I just wish we could all be kind to each other, and social media doesn't play into that.
The Round Table, WayneKSpear.com.
Who is the audience you had in mind when you wrote this book, Angie?
If I thought about an audience when I was writing a novel, I would never write a word. I'd be paralyzed with fear. So I don't. I tell my students, don't censor yourself, just write and just see what comes. And then you can deal with, once I'm going on a book tour, that's when I start to think about audience, because I start to think, now how do I talk about this thing that I made?
Let's say that was my question. That's probably a better question. Now that you're out there, who is your audience? Who are you speaking to? And how is this book now living in the world of these conversations you're having?
Yeah, that's a good question. Frank came to my Vancouver book launch. My audience was mostly white people. Yes, Frank?
Yeah, there was a few. I'm interested that the how the Middle Eastern community is taking an interest in the book as well, because you know our common ancestor was a Syrian immigrant, and people don't know that there was a history of kind of mass immigration from Syria and Turkey, late in the 18th century, before Canada started instituting kind of policies of excluding people from certain countries, kind of like what we're going through in the U.S. right now, where it's kind of like, well, if you're from a European nation, you're welcome. If you're from a non-European nation, you're not. So that's what I did notice at your book launch in Vancouver, is that there mm-hmm. there was a very good representation from the Middle East, and mm-hmm. and they're kind of pretty interested in that, because I'd say we're a very Canadian family.
There's
kind of these where we have these skeletons in our closet and that, and right now it's not really popular to claim any Middle Eastern ancestry, whereas I think you and I growing up, it was kind of just more of a kind of a quirk about our family, like, oh, mm-hmm. we have this ancestor who came from Syria, wow, that's cool, that's exotic, right? And then mm-hmm. somewhere in the late 90s, after the first Iraq war, it was kind of like, okay, don't mention this Middle Eastern ancestor, it became very quiet, right? And then, and I've seen the book. When I first read the book, it's from that perspective. I really saw it kind of as a story of our family, and our mm-hmm. family includes indigenous elements, right? And that's, something that a lot of Canadians don't want to admit, is that, you're asked to choose sides. And you don't actually get to choose those sides, because, Angie, you have blonde hair and blue eyes, so you're very much put in the white category. And then me with my dark skin and brown eyes and black hair is put in the, indigenous category. But, it was really just kind of a genetic roll of the dice to see how each one of us in our family kind of comes out looking like, right? I have, fair-skinned siblings, and I have siblings who are darker than me. And it's just kind of a blending.
We have cousins who are white and have these Middle Eastern looking kids also. Yeah, I told my husband, if our baby turns out looking different than you, don't there is that. Don't worry
don't
about it.
Don't jump to conclusions immediately. So my wife and I had to have very similar conversations. Like, okay, we don't know what these kids are going to look like, so nobody get upset here, right?
Again, lots to look at there, but this, just as that roll of the dice, as you've described it there, Frank, and I have that same thing. I think most of us do in our family. The kids who look like Rez kids and the kids who, like me, are fair. And in the same way, you could play that same sort of metaphor with the book. You could discuss this book in many ways. This book could be described, Angie, as a story of Syrian immigration, which is a very topical subject right now, Syrians coming to Canada.
Nobody's talked about that. For all the different ways the book's been reviewed, nobody's talked about the Syrian element. And very few people have talked about the environmental element other than Frank. But yeah, there are different.
Yeah, I could probably come up with four ways to describe this book based on what's in there and how the story actually. But of course, I think to exclude any or to only look at one is to really not comprehend what this book is and what it's trying to do.
And I guess that brings me back to your conversation about who's the audience. And I think it's a Canadian book. It's about mm-hmm. where we are in Canada right now and how together we can find a way forward to something better. And, I always have said that I like books that start conversations, and I want my books to start conversations. I guess my lesson here is I don't get to control those conversations.
Well, mission accomplished, Angie. You definitely started a conversation here.
Now I'm going to hibernate for a decade.
Well, if you had your druthers, guys, you can both comment on this. What would the discussion be about this book? We've had now the cultural appropriation discussion. We'll certainly have more of that. But what are conversations that you think naturally can be teased out of this work?
What truth and reconciliation looks like for each individual person, because I find that such an abstract notion. Yes, we want truth. Yes, we want reconciliation, but what can we each do to move in that direction? My friend David Alex Robertson, who wrote When We Were Alone, the picture book that won the Governor General's Award, it's about residential schools. he tells a story about reading that to his daughter for the first time. And then his daughter, right as soon as he finished, said, "Can you call Grandpa?" And then she said to her, "Grandpa, I want to learn Cree." And he says, "This is reconciliation." And I cried the first time he told that story. It's so beautiful. And I think, well, what is reconciliation for me? And as uncomfortable as this conversation is, a public conversation, and as much as I'm making mistakes and apologizing and learning, I think this is reconciliation for me. It's not supposed to be comfortable for me. So staying with it and not running and hiding because I'm embarrassed or humiliated or feel beaten down, but just being, okay, well, I have a lot to learn and I messed up and I'm sorry. And tell me now, what can I do next? And sticking with it to mend those relationships, that is reconciliation for me. And that might take a really long time. I don't know. So I think I like that conversation is, what does it look for like for each of us, truth and reconciliation?
Frank, want to weigh in?
Yeah, you know what? I'm starting to miss the days where authors were the conversation starters. It's kind of not the person at the end of a lot of pointy fingers. And that's kind of what it's become, you know, that we have to stop and remember that that authors are primarily artists. You know, they paint a picture, they kind of give a valid, you know, social commentary in their work. So wherever the conversation is going, there are a lot of issues that, we need to talk about, you know, how Indigenous people have been treated, how newcomers to the country are treated,
how the planet is treated.
Yeah, how the planet is treated, definitely. And that doesn't seem where conversations in the literary community have been going lately. It's been going to who's allowed to say what. And I think that's very wrong because, not everybody has a voice. So if somebody is able to start a conversation and start giving voice to the voiceless, I think that's kind of what our job as writers really is to begin those conversations and put them in such a way that, that anybody feels comfortable to weigh in. But personal attacks against the author for kind of opening their mouths in the first place, I think is pretty ridiculous. And to me, it's censorship and, just the social media machine, kind of what it's become. It's been more like, how can I get famous by saying negative things about somebody else's work? And to me, it's kind of lazy. It's pointless. If people were wanting to write works in response to something, like I hope somebody will read In Case I Go and be inspired to write a story from another perspective. And then I'd be happy to read that work. I'm sure Angie would be happy to read that work. Mm-hmm. And, let's get together and let's have a conversation. You know, let's do like a joint, that's for me, one of the biggest problems with authors is that we don't get together often enough. You know, we don't, have these kind of dual readings or commentaries and that. I mean, it's just really strange, you know, because we mm-hmm. are supposed to be the conversation starters and to, you know, kind of help to get the conversation started. We don't need to steer it. We don't need to direct it. And we definitely don't need to be the kind of the spokespeople for those particular issues. We're just here to get the conversation started and make people think about, you know, what is really going on, you know, not what the policymakers want us to think or believe, but that we are supposed to be like a voice of the people.
Yeah. And Frank, your book, Gray Eyes, is a much different kind of book. So when you talk about, we all have our different stories and different perspectives. Yours is focused. It's a story of the Nisichiwayasik people and the coming I don't want to say a savior figure, but a magical figure. Is that a fair description? A powerful figure?
Yeah, I'd say that. I kind of described it as kind of historical fantasy fiction in a way. And my experience has been very different because I was kind of attacked early on by some saying, well, hey, you're talking about our spirituality. You're talking about our teachings. You're talking about our ceremonies. You're doing everything that everybody knows we're never supposed to do. And I said, yes, I am. And they said, well, you can't do that. And I said, really? Because, I'm only accountable to my own community. And my community really came together. I mean, the elders and the political leadership. And they said, no, we agree with what Frank's doing. We're okay with it. We're not all exactly on the same page. But for the most part is like, these are our stories and we want them out there. And, you know, and it really resonated with the youth because it truly is a coming of age story. And, you know, it's putting into perspective, you know, how our ancestors want, you know, our youth to come of age, you know, the idea of proving yourself, you know, as an adult, you know, as rites of passage. And that's something that's been really missing from our community in a lot of ways. And it's helping to bring that back. So, so the conversation was shut down, pretty quickly. I mean, I had fingers pointing at me, you know, you're selling culture and this. And, there were days I'm like, you know, do I even log on to Twitter today? You know, I'm just going to hear some stuff. But I found myself kind of saying the same thing. It's like, okay, well, in your community, in your area, in your tradition, your teachings, fine, do what you want. This is me. This is mine. And that kind of shut it down. And I kind of feel bad because, I feel sometimes I almost steered Angie into this and she doesn't have that, you know, she doesn't have a, you know, like a First Nation, a national government to back her and say, no, we read it. We're cool with it. We like it. We've, you know, we're happy with everything. You know, so that was maybe a flaw when I said, okay, well, here's the process. And I forgot, oh wait, you don't have an entire community of thousands of people who are going to immediately jump behind you and say, no, we gave permission. We allowed this. This is ours. Nobody else gets to comment on what is our story, right? So, so very interesting.
when you said about selling the culture, I have to kind of laugh at the comments about selling the culture or monetizing or gaining profits from, because if anyone looked at the financial statements of a Canadian writer,
it's not really, it's pretty sad.
Yeah, word to use, yeah.
Yeah, I always thought my wife describes my writing as an expensive hobby. And she always says, like, you know, I think you give away more books than you sell. And that's kind of true. I do a lot of donating of my books to First Nation schools and that. So anytime I win an award or, you know, or get even kind of speaking fees or something from a university, I immediately go and buy wholesale copies of my book and donate it to a First Nation school, which I know can't afford it. So my wife's always like, you know, for an accountant, it's kind of strange how you can see a lot more revenue than actually exists when you go start spending on donations, right? So, so it's a very different side of my personality. I said, well, I'm a Gemini, you know, there's two of me and they don't always get along. So,
and given the way the conversations about my process and my right to publish this book have gone, I really don't want to make money from it. So I've talked to, there's a writer's retreat, writers' workshops offered fairly regularly. There's only been the first annual one, but there's plans for more at the St. Eugene Resort, which is Tanaha owned on Tanaha land. And I've talked to the organizers and said I will donate money for a Tanaha scholarship, so to pay the flight and the tuition for an aspiring writer to attend that on a regular basis, because I don't have any interest in making money from this book.
And I just want to plug your book, Frank, Gray Eyes. A lovely book, and very engaging. I find the prose just, yeah, it's just very absorbing. I enjoyed it. And that came
back. Well, I'm working on the second book right now. So it's going to be a continuing saga. I've actually got 7 books planned in the series, one for each of the 7 teachings. So right now I'm working on Gray Eyes and the teaching of the bear. And aspires to bring to light some of the issues surrounding the murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls and their plight. And basically what I'm trying to do with the series is throw our modern problems at our ancestors to be able to demonstrate how our ancestors would have sought to resolve or address those particular issues. And just kind of, again, to kind of start a conversation around, you know, what is happening in a particular political issue in that. And this one might be biting off a little more than I can chew, but again, I'll follow a very similar process as what I suggested to Angie, was to talk to the people who are living it, and see what their thoughts are, because there'll be a lot of insight into that, and then make them kind of aware of what it is you're doing.
Now, if I can get up on my soapbox and make my appeal, I mean, I wish people would read books and then form an opinion about them. And if something if something bothers them, then they can cite page and line, and we can discuss that. But discussing a book by proxy frankly pisses me off. I used to teach, yeah. And you could always mm-hmm. spot the people who came to class or wrote their essay and they hadn't done their homework. They'd gone to Blockbuster and rented the movie adaptation or they'd, you know, give you somebody else's reading, or they'd just regurgitate Cole's notes. And this feels a bit like that to me. I'm honestly not even sure if John Kay read the book. Maybe I'll ask him.
Oh, he says in his essay he didn't. No, he says in his essay he has not read it. Nobody's read it. If as many people were talking about my book as we're talking about John Kay's essay, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, and I think that's not only a huge problem for intellectual reasons, but I think morally and just aesthetically, I mean, where are we going to get if people don't read books and then decide to talk about them not really knowing what they're talking about? It would just be nice if people would read the damn book and not just mm-hmm. somebody yeah. else's opinion. Maybe I'm old fashioned.
Well, and I think a lot of the criticism I saw, especially on Twitter, was kind of like, John Kay wrote another article. I thought we lynched him, you know, didn't he crawl under a rock already, you know? And I was pretty taken aback by just the fact that, you know, it's like, okay, well, you see the author, you have an opinion, you know what this is going to be about. So, you know, people read the article and, there's very little criticism on the content of the article, and it seems to all revolve around the fact that either, you know, like, well, Angie Abdu, why would you even talk to that guy? You know, like, he's, you know, persona non grata kind of thing, right? You know, and how, where does he get the, you know, audacity to publish an article? I'm like, and that's not censorship, you know, like saying, okay, this person can no longer write? Really? You know, like, that's pretty ridiculous, so.
I'm going to come back to the idea Frank said about having more collaborative public events, and I'm hoping Frank and I have talked about doing an event together in Kelowna in the spring when the highways are better, and I'm looking forward yeah. to that. So we can. I was finding things go much better face-to-face with the audience and with other writers, and like I said, even if there's diverse, well, there should be diversity of opinion, always, right? We treasure diversity. We should have room for diversity of opinion, but that always goes better in person than in media or social media.
Well, I have read the book, and anything I struggled with had nothing to do with any of the things that I've read. My own personal feeling was that I'm still not sure about the integration of the genres and throwing myself 100% into the story, but, you know, and this only would matter to me because I'm a philosophical materialist. I don't actually believe that people talk to the dead, or that, you know, that people come back, or that if we're named after somebody, I'm not a very good Indian, and this is something that I haven't felt comfortable to talk a lot about. But as somebody who doesn't believe in the Great Spirit or spirits in general, even a lot of things that Indigenous people say to me, like, well, okay, that's nice that you believe that. I don't. So I think what I struggled with is simply my own difficulty throwing myself into a genre that isn't either following the rules of fantasy. It's like, okay, I know that Romulans don't exist, but I can throw myself into Star Trek. What I can't do is throw myself into an episode of Star Trek where I'm being told that, no, actually, these Romulans are really real and they really exist, and if you believe in them, then it will empower you to do certain things. I mean, those are the kinds of things in any book that I struggle with, and so it's probably just my problem as a philosophical materialist, but anyone who's able to make that leap into this kind of mixed world where it's social realism and there are all of these things going on that, from my point of view, aren't socially real, but they're real in the context of this novel. Does that make sense?
Yes, I had such a weird time writing this book because it's so different from my other books and it came to me so differently. And I had those moments when I was, what on earth is going on here? This character is this character, but she's also this character, and it's happening in this time, but it's also happening in that time and the other time. Like, what is going on? And it felt bigger than me, and I had to trust the process, which has been easier to do in my other books, which were social realism. I could trust the process, and then in the end I would have a book, but this one was so different. And so, I don't read fantasy really, or write fantasy typically. So, I'm with you there.
Well, Angie, I've read the reviews, and they're all actually very positive and very praising your work. So, I think actually you're doing pretty good.
I know it doesn't feel that way, Angie, but it's true.
I just, you know, I like people that like me. I don't really love conflict, so this has been hard. I tell myself I'm doing fine, and then I look in the mirror, and I have not one, but two cold sores. Like, I don't kind of stress well. But, yeah, as like I said, if it was a conversation that was happening that I didn't happen to find myself in the middle of it, I would be watching with great interest. So, and I'm really making an effort to not get sucked into the social media. I get offline, and I spent the other whole day with my Tanaha friend Anna Sam Hudson. I spent time talking to the cultural liaison that I originally worked with. I spent time talking to one of the elders I presented to, and I spent time talking to Frank. And people that were very, very opposed to the Jonathan K essay, like Alicia Elliott, we got on the phone, and I find when I take these conversations off social media, we can make progress. We don't necessarily agree on everything, but we can feel good about a good human interaction, and like we can find common ground, and we can change our minds, and we can try to find a way forward. So I'm just trying to pull out of social media a bit, which does not seem to have that result.
Yeah, wherever reconciliation happens, it's not going to be on Twitter.
Not going to be on Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for giving me your time, guys. I think this was a great conversation, and I endorse the idea of taking these things offline. I have much different conversations in the real world, and that's where mm-hmm. I think we need to have them. That's my view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.